Welcome to the session. This is on to understand how Adam Data Solutions is using SQL Server 2016 to accelerate their business. My name is Mike Weiner. I'm with the CAT team. I have a slide, the next slide, we'll talk a little bit about my team. And my co-presenters here are Eric and Joey. I'll let them kind of give a little background on themselves.
Hi, I'm Eric Nordlander. An extra disclaimer, Adam Data Solutions is a pretty new name for us, so if we say Realty Track, we apologize, but it's only been Adam Data Solutions for 2 months now. I have been with Adam Data Solutions for nearly 9 years. I've worked with SQL Server since SQL Server 2000, and it's been about 13 years of experience now.
Yep. I'm Joey Dantoni. I'm principal consultant at Demetrian Associates Consulting. I'm a data platform MVP. Adam/RealtyTrack is my customer, and Eric and I worked together pretty extensively on this project to get started with 2016 and implement a lot of these features that we're going to talk about here today to kind of improve their performance and give better flow through in the product.
Yeah. So just a quick background. Adam Data Solutions was in the SQL Server 2016 Technology Adoption Program. Which is a program that we run for early adopters that will adopt the new technologies and the new features. In fact, Adam Data Solutions went live in production initially on SQL Server 2016 in August of 2015.
Yeah.
So they were about 10 months before GA of the product. They were in production.
Brave and a little bit crazy.
We teamed together, so we appreciated it. And the goal for this session is to have Eric and Joey and the team talk a little bit about how Adam has adopted SQL Server 2016 and the technologies, and so you can learn about what technologies they're using. Another goal, specifically for my team that we always try and push, is learnings and experiences. So hopefully they can share some of the learnings and experiences, and you can gain some insights into when you're looking to adopt SQL Server 2016 and new technologies to apply to your implementation. And just a quick question for the room. So there are a couple technologies that we're working with. Show of hands for SQL Server 2016 in general. Who's done testing or is in production? Of course.
You don't count, Danny.
One install counts. Any counts. What about, so particular technologies that we're going to talk about that Adam Data Solutions has worked on. Who's worked with availability groups? Okay, a lot. That's column store. Okay, a little bit less.
Temporal.
Yeah, temporal. Temporal. Okay, that's a cool one. And we have a nice little demo.
Yeah.
On that. And what about R in general? So SQL Server R Services is the last technology. It's a new technology.
Anyone's name begin with R?
Okay, so it's good that we have a little setup slide on that as well. We also have some reference slides to some of the more technology deep dives on these particular technologies.
Sort of. We did some testing with 2014, but we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Lost user. We'll have to move here. Sorry, we just lost some of the presentations on one
Let's
of
do
the
flip.
No, no, we will.
Yeah, I just flipped it over and those are dead.
Okay, sorry about that.
Do you want me to just
Yeah.
Okay, so just really, really quickly, just a little bit of background on myself and my team. Again, Mike Weiner, I'm part of the SQL Customer Advisory team. Our primary goal is to focus is to work with customers who are adopting new SQL technologies that's both Azure and on-premises, and that's how I got engaged with Adam Data Solutions, Eric and Joey, et cetera, as they were working with the SQL Server 2016 Technology Adoption Program and these new technologies. In doing those engagements, we'll do design reviews. We have a lab in Redmond. In fact, Adam Data Solutions, for part of their testing, came to our lab and did some testing that they'll talk about there. And our goal is to take those learnings and certainly improve the product and the services that we are delivering, and then, of course, share those learnings with the community. So we have a blog site, and we also do that through events like this. So with that, let me turn it over to the star. stars of the show.
Yeah. I just want to give you guys a little agenda on what we're doing. We're going to tell you who we are, who Adam Data Solutions is, and what we do. Tell you a little bit about our architecture and how we're using. Joey's going to help me tell you how we upgraded to SQL Server 2016 and how it's helping our business. Adam Data Solutions, first and foremost, we're a data company. Our product is our data warehouse. Our core data sets include our property characteristics, tax, deed, mortgage, and foreclosure data. We also host three websites, realtytrack.com, aforementioned, HomeFacts, and Home Disclosure. A little bit about our process is we have many different sources for data. Since the data warehouse is the core of our business, performance of the data warehouse affects how much we can sell. The more customers we have means we have more data. More data we have means more atomizing, which is our spin on the data. I'm going to tell you a little bit about where we started from and how we process our data.
So to answer your question and to give a little bit of history on this, we started that in 2012. The warehouse was less than fully optimized, and we'll talk about that here when Eric starts giving some details. We were also running on older hardware. So when I first started checking out the server, we had 64 gig of RAM. The data warehouse at the time was about 12 terabytes. Page life expectancy, as you can imagine, if you're a SQL Server DBA, page life expectancy is how long a page of data is expected to live in memory, was below that old recommendation of 300, which is pretty outdated, as we all know. So we added 128 gig of memory, or we up to 128 gig, because that was all the server would take. Fortunately, we had new hardware in the way, which we'll talk about, but let's show some of those results.
So our process, we have tons of different sources. We have people that go out to county clerk's offices and gather records from physical books. We download data through scrapes, Census Bureau, just to name a few of them. They come in all kinds of formats, flat files, XML, Access, DBs, even Excel. Each one has its own schedule, so we have large county data from counties such as Los Angeles, who will post foreclosures, recorder, deed data multiple times throughout the day. We're scraping those throughout the day. We have people pulling them. Smaller counties, they may only post a file or to their websites once a week. At our peak, our imports are about 4 to 5 million a day, unless we have a large county update. If an entire county is going to refresh their data, which they do periodically, we will get the entire county in one day, so our numbers will bump. And there's 3,200 counties, so they're never on the same schedule. Our data warehouse, this is where we put our spin on the data. This is how we translate it and organize it so that our customers can easily see it, or before we can send it to them, they can easily see it. The output DB is where we have the data prepared before shipment. Our shipment includes match and appends, where a customer will send us a list of addresses, and they would like to see the foreclosure information, tax, deed, mortgage that we have on public from public records. We can also show them building permits, and then we produce a custom flat file that we send out to them via FTP. There's also bulk products that we sell, which are used for marketing, research. We have many universities that we send data to. And they can pick any format, any column names. It's a very customizable product. As you can see here, we have a sample of one of our flat files that we receive. This is just a standard standard property file with parsed addresses. And not everyone comes in so cleanly as this tab delimited file. Some are much more challenging. We have a lot of customers that still deal with fixed width formats.
So to the audience, does this sound familiar a lot of people have data warehouses, this type of.
So to share a little bit, we have three main areas that we're concerned with: the loading, delivery, and reporting. For the loading, our import using SSIS, just our daily imports, and we're taking about 3.5 hours. Right after that would complete, the bulk licensing would commence, and that would take up to 4.5 hours a day. So we're talking 8 hours a day of just getting the data ready to send to customers. At the time, we only had about 10 customers in a line, and we could not run them in parallel. Our servers were just not powerful enough, as Joey mentioned. So we had to do them all in a line, one after another. And as they would finish for one day, the next day would start right back up. It became a real challenge if we wanted to expand. And if we had a custom, or if we had a monthly file to send out, some of our customers can't accept a daily ingest, it took a significant amount of time to align those with the daily feeds. It was a lot of juggling. The reporting, we have internal tabular cubes that our analysts use to create reports and sell. And we have a couple of reports that we must have before we can sell any data. Our salespeople can't sell counties that we don't have. And if we don't have coverage in a small county in Alaska, we have to be able to tell them because some of them are very interested in it. Those reports were taking all day long.
Thanks. So I engaged in December of 2014, and I started doing some analysis on the servers. And one of the first things I noticed was this is a pretty classic data warehouse. So there is a data warehouse, and there's some other databases involved in the process that also act very similar to a data warehouse in their nature. What I mean by that is the workload is bulk loading in large analytic queries. So like I mentioned, we were on a pretty slow server. One of the other issues we had was I/O latency. So the I/O latency was averaging 90 plus milliseconds, and even higher than that under peak volume. We had 12 terabytes of spinning disk. And in the 2012 database, we were making no use of compression. There was a little bit of partitioning, but partitioning, it isn't necessarily a performance feature. It's more of a management feature. So one of the first things I wanted to do was talk about implementing column store indexes. So my initial approach was going to go with SQL Server 2014. In SQL Server 2014, column store indexes became writable, which was a nice feature to have. In 2012, you couldn't update them, which was a little bit problematic. It could work in a warehouse. But so one of the things we talked about, and we'll talk about here in a couple of slides, was using always-on availability groups to scale out their data delivery. It's a little bit of a confusing model if you're not up to speed with their data, but I'll walk through it. One problem we had was column store indexes weren't supported on readable secondaries. So I think I emailed Mike in like February of 2015 and was like, hey, did you guys fix this in 2016? And he's like, why? And I'm like, I have a case. But we'll talk a little bit about that. But column store indexes give us a bunch of things. So this is a really optimal design in a data warehouse. So we looked at all the fact tables, because that's what Microsoft recommends for guidance. And we looked at very large dimensions. And what column stores are going to do is simplify our indexing strategy. We had lots of tables that had fact tables that are very wide, have 400 and 500 columns. What's the right way to index a table that has 400 or 500 columns with B-tree indexes? With a column store, you're effectively indexing every column individually with having only one index. So you're going to save a great deal of space. You're going to reduce your management overhead because you're not going to have to maintain rebuilding indexes. And column store indexes don't use statistics in a traditional way. The other thing that's a huge benefit is we have column elimination on queries. What this means, we issue a query maybe against that 500 column table. It's only selecting 30 or 40 of those columns. With column store, you don't have to scan those. So the database only processes the columns that are in a query. This is really a nice thing. The other thing that's good, Eric talked about the data loading process and how long that would take. With column store indexes, they've been optimized to do batch loading of data if you're using bulk insert type of operations. I have a cool demo we're not going to do today, but if you load 102,399 rows, which doesn't use that bulk insert mechanism, it takes about three times as long as if you insert 102,400 rows. So when you hit that mechanism, you'll get loading a lot faster. Another thing that really helps Atom, I didn't say it, is batch mode. So batch mode is this effective column store indexes where instead of processing data row by row, SQL Server processes at about 900 rows at a time. We've actually seen some bugs in queries where we've not hit this and it's shifted into row mode, and that query has taken 3 to 4 times longer. Almost every query they do is a large aggregation. Many have large aggregate windowing functions. Almost all have a pretty large sort at the end, and that's a nice new enhancement in SQL Server 2016 is that sort is supported in batch mode.
Yeah, so I think just to comment on that, and I mean, batch mode was this optimization that we have with column store even in 2014, but we added a number of new scenarios and commands where you can basically, we can optimize for batch mode when executing that T-SQL.
The other thing that's cool is inline in your execution plan, other operations that aren't necessarily in the columns, using the column store index can support batch mode in 2016, so there's a few other things. One other thing we've run into, and this came up as soon as we started doing the design, column stores are really good at scanning. They're not really good at doing point lookups. And if you have to do a large join on two fact tables, they're also not too good at that. SQL Server 2016 supports having secondary B-tree indexes in conjunction with a clustered column store. So we're able to take advantage of that on a handful of tables. I think we have it on about 20 tables, or 20 indexes anyway, for those large joins. And there's a few queries I know we run where they do point lookups instead of, they do point lookups and scans, but most of the workload is scanned, so it makes sense. Also new for 2016 is this text predicate pushdown. And Atom does a lot of searches on zip codes, which are effectively treated as text, and some address searching. So they're also receiving a great deal of benefit for that, from that. So here's just some of the savings. So column store is pretty much the best compression you're gonna get in the SQL Server. Just because of the nature that you're storing data in individual columns, and there's a lot of data in common. And these are just some of our largest tables, but our average space savings was 3.3 times, and that's just on tables. So you can see that fact property document table went from almost 500 gig to just over 100. The other kind of cool thing about this data is, so the red numbers on the left are from December of 2014. The blue numbers are from now. So we have more data and more customers, and our data warehouse is still a lot smaller. So that enabled us to do a few things. Since we reduced the size of the data, it became much more affordable to move to a solid state drive solution. So we had low I/O latency. The other thing is, we didn't have to manage indexes. So I'm talking about the space savings here, and that's just in terms of the clustered index on the base table on the old system. That's not including all the non-clustered indexes we got rid of by implementing column store.
Yeah, and I mean, just in terms of other customers' experiences, that's usually one of the huge things. I mean, typically, page compression, you'll get something like somewhere between 1 and 3x. With the column store, with the clustered column store compression on top of that, you'll get another 2 to 3x, sometimes potentially up to 4x. But most people kind of come back and say, listen, by eliminating all these non-clustered indexes, I save huge amounts of space overall. So.
Yeah, so I admitted, we changed from spinning disk to SSDs, but still. The I/O latency was 92 milliseconds on average on the old system, and we're at 5 as of yesterday. And Eric can talk to this a little bit. How many customers do you have now?
We have 80 bulk customers, another 40 or so match and append customers. And that's just the big guys.
And you have some more data sources, right?
And we have a lot more data sources.
Yeah, so we were able to up the volume, up the workload. The SSDs help, but the column stores help a lot more. So the next thing we wanted to do, and I'm going to kind of try to explain this as best I can, because folks have had trouble understanding that at Microsoft that I'm presenting with. We wanted to scale out the workload. So Eric showed earlier we had kind of a data warehouse and then an output database. So with always-on availability groups, we can read and write on the primary, but we can't write on the secondary. So the way I kind of thought of this architecture is we're going to have the data warehouses be the reference data, and then we're going to have a database where we're going to do the output that's not going to be part of the availability group. High availability wasn't the biggest concern here. It was a concern, and we take advantage of high availability, but it was more to be able to deliver in parallel. So We can have one set of jobs that's running on the primary and writing to that output database, and another set of jobs that's running on the secondary and writing to that output database. So that was why we went with this approach. There's a few benefits we got here. SQL 2016 doesn't compress the traffic on sync replicas. Our servers are next to each other in the data center, so we get really good throughput there. We also allowed the analyst, the internal analyst at Realty Track, to kind of perform their research workloads without impacting production. So they were able to do their research on the secondary while we were doing deliveries on the primary. And the big thing here that's new for 2016 is column store indexes with readable secondaries are supported. In the past, column store indexes weren't compatible with snapshot isolation mode in SQL Server. Your secondary always runs in snapshot isolation. That got fixed in 2016. So the other thing that's cool that we've talked about, we hopefully will have to do someday, is being able to scale out more nodes. More nodes equals more licensing, but if we need the workload, it pays for itself. So here's kind of what that architecture looks like. So the input's the same as Eric showed before. Here we have two servers. We have about 792 gig of RAM on each of them, so we went far up on the RAM. We're still running 8 CPUs, so these aren't superdomes or anything like that. We're using a sync AG, automatic failover. The availability group allows for parallel delivery of data sets. So we're also taking advantage of, and we just kind of implemented this last week, but we're taking advantage of read-only routing to route some traffic to whatever the secondary is. As Eric mentioned, there's a tabular cube on the right side. One of the other things that's been so fun about this project is I really feel like Adam took the checklist of the features in 2016 that were new and treated it like a checklist. They took advantage of a lot of the new DAX functions that are in SSAS Tabular 2016 that they weren't able to use before or had to do a lot of custom code. Same FTP process, we're just able to kind of double our delivery.
So some of the results that we saw. Our data loading, which was, I mentioned before, taking as long as 8 hours the entire day from source to bulk licensing, we were down to about half an hour for the entire day. We all of a sudden didn't have this overlap of trying to produce files and populate the data warehouse. These are all current workloads.
Yeah, so the question was, are those what? What, Mike?
Yeah.
Yes.
So the question was, are those times with the old or current workload? And the answer was, it's with the current workload. So.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, and before I mentioned we couldn't run our clients in parallel, we had one line that they went through and it ran all day. Now we're running as many as 10 clients at a time. I remember the first morning whenever we kicked this off, I came in and all of our client files were done. I thought there could have been a problem. Very similar to our field population reports. We called it a weekend job because we would have it fire on the weekends when no customer deliveries were going. When we first started testing it, we fired it off and came back and looked, and the time was, it was done. So we thought there was a problem. We had that sinking feeling like, oh man, we created a bug, there's something. So we spent hours researching it. It was accurate. We went from a weekend job to a water break job just for this one report. And it was huge because now we had, same day, we could tell our salespeople what they could sell. Our total time saved on at current rate is 25 times for loading. And just as you can see, our monthly deliveries went from a whole week worth of work down to a morning. So you could come in, fire it off, and before you went to lunch, you're delivering files.
Yeah, so I'd just say this is a kind of a common scenario that we've seen. I don't know if anybody else has adopted Column Store and kind of seen this, but I mean, a lot of times, especially for data warehouse workloads, this is allowing customers to basically do more with this data, and then people ask for more, and it's kind of a cycle there. So.
Yeah.
It's hard to, the question was, you know, lots of hardware changes, how do you quantify this exactly? Yeah, that's hard to quantify. That said, just the compression we got allowed us to do the things like SSD, right? So the hardware probably wasn't, because it's one of the things we're evaluating now, is do we need to expand the hardware from a CPU perspective? I think memory, we're fine, but we'd benefit from a wider processing platform. Licensing, that's the only thing that's thinking about. But we're actually probably gonna do some tests in Azure in the next month with large VMs to just get a sample. Couple of other things we learned with this. We wanted to make some changes to the ETL process just to make sure we were loading data in big enough sections. Because one of the things you wanna avoid with column store is having open row groups where you're because those are B-tree files, or B-tree tables effectively on disk, and you're not getting as much benefit. Denny came in the back and helped while I was out 1 week and helped take some merge statements and change them into an insert and update. Merge is easy to code and useful sometimes, but especially in large volumes, a lot of times we see, and might cover your ears, it doesn't perform that well. Just ask Aaron Bertrand, who's a SQL MVP, and read his 12-page connect item. But doing so resulted in a 75% performance increase to the ETL. The other thing, and we just found out about this last week, we knew we were having problems with row groups less than a million rows. They were getting smaller, and we weren't 100% sure why. This is the second longest DMV name I've ever seen, because there's another one that I think has this and operational stats behind it. SysDM, DB, column store, row group, physical stats, and the column name here is trim reason. And it will show you why your column store was less than a million rows when it was compressed. So a couple of things here that we saw mainly, memory pressure. So if the server is under memory pressure, it will not build as big of a row group as it would like. So that was about 20% of our cases. The other probably 70 or 80% of our cases was dictionary size. The dictionary size is a hard limit of 16 megabytes. Dictionaries where the column store index stores its statistics and metadata about the data that's in the table. When you have columns, when you have tables that are 500 columns wide, that can be a little problematic with that 16 meg limit. So next, Eric's going to talk about temporal, which is it's right there.
Sorry. So we have a few cases where we're using temporal. We have data audits that we have to do for revenue sharing. There's a few types of geopoints that we have on properties. We have a standard and a premium. And the premium we have to pay our supplier. Customers can add and take this feature away if they want to test with it. So we had to be able to tell what timelines they were on this. And it was just a very easy change to flip temporal on, which we'll show you how to do. A bigger case, which takes a lot more effort, took a lot more effort, were the attribute changes for properties, for tax year over year, even month over month. There are times, I mentioned earlier, that counties will give us full refreshes on their tax data. Then they'll have a revamp of it, they'll have some kind of change for the entire county, and they'll repost it to us. We were only capturing our changes quarterly. We didn't have triggers set up. We weren't set up to record this every single change. It took a lot of time to write the code, the triggers, the procedures that were needed. But we easily turned it from a quarterly process of every once in a while recording, seeing some changes. We were able to see all changes. So if we did get those two county files back to back, we saw both updates to the tax record. It's very important for a lot of our customers. They want to see this change over time for marketing purposes, to see how to market in that county. There's a lot of information they can gain from it.
So Eric's going to do a quick demo now?
So we have a little scenario here. The scenario is tax data being updated. What we have is a sample table here of records. from Georgia. We have our Atom ID, which is our unique property identifier, the city, state, zip, and address, and a little bit of tax information. This is far from complete, clearly not hundreds of rows or hundreds of columns. The tax year, assessed value is the total of improvement value and land value, which are taxed differently depending on the county. And then the total tax amount paid. So this is what the county reports to us as being paid. One of the items, you have to have a primary key to have temporal. So our primary key is on Atom ID. So the first thing we're going to do is turn on, add some columns to enable the feature for temporal tables. Just use the default name of sysstart time, and you have to have a date time too. And any time the row starts for the start time, and for the end time, any time the row ends. It cannot be nullable, and a default is a good idea. The period, sysstart time, is how it defines the temporal. So we're going to go ahead and add that to our table. So now we've added the columns, and now to enable the temporal table, it's system versioning equals on. You can specify a name like I have here, or you can just let SQL Server give you a name.
So Joey, you're probably going to talk a little bit about this on the next slide, but so for Atom Data Solutions implementation on temporal, like how long did it kind of take to?
Richard and I had a meeting one afternoon when I was there, and then we implemented it. It's such a quick process to do this versus triggers or anything like that that requires a big development effort. And triggers are terrible anyway. They're good for shooting things, like yourself in the foot. But this was just an afternoon. So like Eric shows, you can see that the table is system versioned, and then it shows the underlying history table nested there underneath.
And this is a user table. This is not.
Yeah, if you expand that out real quick. Yes, so you can see everything on the history table.
And as you can see, it matches. Well, that's probably not helpful. A little better. This is new for me. The system version comment in history, it wasn't. If you didn't specify the name, and you let SQL Server generate a name for you, you would have to do a little bit of searching to find what your temporal table was. This addition of adding it to the node is really quite helpful.
One thing if you're not familiar with SQL Server 2016, Microsoft separated Management Studio from the install. So you get a monthly release of Management Studio now, so they're able to make changes more quickly.
So now I'm
going to... Yes, there's a reason for it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead and show you a before picture of some of our records here. We have a few addresses. I'm sorting by our ID, so they're always going to pop out the same. 2014 tax year, and this guy paid $66 in taxes. Lucky them.
Is that real data?
this is real data.
Wow.
And you can see our columns added here.
Yeah, this is the default to the values Eric set.
I'm going to go ahead and increment our tax year by year, and we're going to say the taxes increased by 1.5% year over year. We're going to give a little delay, and then increment again by another 2.5% for the next year, which for this guy still won't be a big change. Typically, tax amounts are paid once a year, or your taxes are paid once a year. In California, I know that we have the ability to pay them twice a year, so it's split. When I was mentioning the county's posting files multiple times, maybe they have an update to it. They when they post these files, they will post them and let us know that it's a full file, what's changing. We can then tell our customers this kind of information. We can share with them very easily that there was a full update. Taxes have been fully assessed and reported by the county, and we can report this back to our customer. That happens over months. I'm sorry, I don't have months to turn on Temporal and show you this. So it's happened only 7 seconds apart. So we're going to pretend we paid 2 years of taxes in 7 seconds.
We didn't want to make you wait here for 3 months.
And we'll go ahead and show you how the data is now for our guy here. You can see now we're at tax year 2016. And he is now going to be paying, he has now paid $68 in taxes. And my condition was there must have been a tax amount. So we say that this record has stayed static and has not changed. And you can see how here the system, the start time has moved forward. I used this little CTE to go ahead and grab a date from our sample that we updated. And we're going to use it with the built-in functions for using our temporal table. We don't ever have to reference our history table. We can just use these features to pull the data. So we have our same gentleman here, and we can see his two previous tax amounts, taxes that he paid, tax years 2014 and 2015. And you can see how the start time has moved from each update. So the first year he paid $66, then $67.
So if you've worked with slowly changing dimensions in a data warehouse before, this is a similar concept. And we're just going to do improvement. This is a similar concept. It's just automated, and it works really well. So there's a few use cases you can use this for. A few things, the way we implemented this, we had 5 tables that were ranging in size from very small to very large. One of the things we did was put the history tables in a separate file group because they're going to continue to grow over time. We didn't want to store those on a solid state drive, so we're storing them in a hard drive. You can also use column store for compression. One of the things we've talked about is using column store archival compression, which will buy us another 20 to 30%. It just depends on how much the data is going to be accessed. Like I mentioned, you can also use all the base tables use a B-tree or a column store.
Yeah, so that's kind of a nice scenario that we've seen a lot of customers adopt as well, where they just had a different indexing scheme on their history tables.
Yeah. So the next thing we're going to talk about, I mentioned that Adam really used the new features list as a checklist of things to implement, it felt like. This came up in probably the beginning of 2016. After R services got integrated, and if you're not familiar with R, it will have a little high level on it, but it's a statistical modeling language used by a lot of data scientists. Adam wanted to produce accurate and timely valuations of real estate properties using SQL Server. And I'll let Eric talk to this slide a little bit.
So an estimated value is based on taxes or sales or any information we have available on the property. We're able to build this estimated value to sell to our customers. And the better your estimated value, the more you fetch for that information. We have about 110 residential properties, 110 million residential properties that we're trying to retrieve this value for. And we have a time frame of 3 to 4 days. That's our goal, is to run the entire set in 3 or 4 days, which doesn't sound like a lot of time, but we need it done every single month.
So SQL Server introduced R services. Like I mentioned, R is a statistical modeling language. This integrates with SQL Server 2016. And R by itself tends to be rather memory intensive in how it's utilized traditionally. And it's not necessarily very efficient at doing the kinds of batch operations that databases can be. With integrating R with SQL Server, you take advantage of all the parallelism and pulling data power that SQL Server delivers, plus some of the transformations and functions that SQL Server has. So you can pre-bake your data in SQL Server. Some other examples besides this valuation, you might do sales forecasting, efficiency, predictive maintenance. I just want to plug, Bob Ward's doing a session, if any of you are members of SQL Pass, for the one of the virtual chapters next week on how to kind of be a DBA for R, and where he talks a lot about how this works inside of SQL Server. I highly recommend the talk, just because it's a pretty neat way. There's a couple ways you can use Resource Governer to control things. We haven't had to do that so much, but cool thing on how it works.
When we first started, this was our cat lab. When we showed up, we could only produce about 200 valuations. It says per minute there. That's a typo. It was per hour. It was we can only get about 5,000 a day. There were 7 R scripts, all in separate files that loaded functions. If you know anything about R, it loads everything in linearly and then calls what it needs. That would give us about 2,000 days to generate 1 month's worth of data for estimated values. And we need to do this every month. So working with the lab team, working with some Superdome servers.
Not Superdomes, just big servers.
Some very big servers. We learned a lot about this R model and how to properly design it. And by the time we left, we were producing nearly 12,000 valuations a minute. So we're getting 670,000-ish a day. Which is easily reached in 3 or 4 days.
So a few things we did. By having the computation in data in the same place, that was pretty easy. Eric and I, working with their statistician and Joe Sack from the CAT team, was very helpful because we were able to quickly tune the R code. And in this case, we had a large number of smaller data sets versus large-scale streaming processing, which is more common in a statistical modeling thing. A couple of big things, obviously, this is kind of just best development practices. Make small changes to your R code and test the performance impact. And you want to debug your code in native R tools before deploying the SQL Server, which I'll show in the next slide as to why. And the other thing here, if you're working with R, there's a great blog post by Joe Sack from the CAT team about R services early customer learnings, and you can grab that by either Googling it, or that link is case sensitive, so it's bit.ly/SQL R services.
Yeah, so just a comment on that. I mean, we had a couple customers, of course. Adam Data Solutions was one of them that come into our lab and did around a week and we type engagements. And in fact, Joe, we reference his presentation in this deck as well, so he's doing a more deep dive into early experiences and customer learnings on using SQL Server R services as well. So these type of experiences are kind of from that, and then they're integrated into Joe's blog.
One other interesting thing is, for us, this wasn't really a memory-intensive process. It was more a CPU-intensive process for what we were doing, and not in one individual process with CPU, so getting lots of parallelism was good. And we kind of designed the data in a way that we can scale it out. So here is why you want to debug your R code in R Studio or some R client before moving it to Management Studio. I'm sure everyone's written a lot of dynamic SQL and had that lovely experience of trying to debug it. Kind of the same concept in R code. So it shows up. We use this SP execute external script procedure. We declare the language as R. And then here we're adding a few packages and just running some data.
Yeah, and I think to the last slide, like Joey mentioned, I mean, definitely our experience. I mean, I think our lab was definitely helpful and enhanced by having kind of the data scientists and the people that were familiar with R, and then kind of the DBAs and the people that were, or the developers that were familiar with that type of workload. And so a lot of the data scientists will typically be familiar with debugging stuff in their solution, and kind of doing that in isolation and then kind of combining the two as a last step. And then also having experts to optimize certain pieces of the code and then kind of put it together.
Yeah. And they have a tool that's kind of like an execution plan called R Profile. So that'll give them the R profile of, it's effectively the execution plan in R for their script. So a couple of other things we did, and this, I'm sure you've heard a lot about the query store because there's been a bunch of talks about it. It's a great, great feature. I think it's your favorite feature.
Yes.
So 2 weeks ago, we had this query go kind of crazy and really hammer the server, and I caught it. A couple of jobs failed when it happened. But In the past, we didn't know what it was. We just knew something happened between 8 and 8:17 in the morning, and we had to identify it. So I'm on the phone with Eric and Richard. Richard's Eric's boss, and we're like, who the heck was running something that took down all this stuff? So with the query store, we were able to kind of zoom in effectively and say, on every database, what was running between 8 and 8:17? And then we found this one query that had, it was a column store query that something had dumped to row mode, and it had a giant sort, and the sort was not in batch, it was in row mode, so we had a very, from a CPU perspective, expensive sort that pegged the CPU, we think. But that was just one of the things we could do. The other thing is extending the platform to the cloud. So that valuation model we talked about with R, it's a 3-day process, so it's a really great way to use Azure, because it's only gonna take 3 days. Why pay for a license and servers? We're only running something once a month for 3 days. Just spin up some pretty big VMs and spin them down, and it's a very cost-effective way to do that.
Yeah, so with that, I think we're out of time.
Yeah.
We're more than happy to stick around and answer any questions you have offline.
Cool.
Thank you very much for the time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, go to the next slide, too. Also, evaluations, please fill out the evaluations. Love feedback, and if you enjoy sessions like this, I'd, again, encourage you to fill out the evaluation and let them know that so we can do more of them. Thank you.